A short while later, Mariam and her mother brought two steaming bowls of vegetable shorwa and two loaves of bread. "I'm sorry we can't offer you meat," Wahid said. "Only the Taliban can afford meat now." "This looks wonderful," I said. It did, too. I offered some to him, to the kids, but Wahid said the family had eaten before we arrived. Farid and I rolled up our sleeves, dipped our bread in the shorwa, and ate with our hands. As I ate, I noticed Wahid's boys, all three of them thin with dirt-caked faces and short-cropped brown hair under their skullcaps. They were stealing furtive glances at my digital wristwatch. The youngest whispered something in his brother's ear. The brother nodded and didn't take his eyes off my watch. The oldest of the boys, I guessed his age at about 12, rocked back and forth, his gaze glued to my wrist. After dinner, after I had washed my hands with the water Mariam poured from a clay pot, I asked for Wahid's permission to give his boys a hadiyah, a gift. He said no, but when I insisted, he reluctantly agreed. I unsnapped the wristwatch and gave it to the youngest of the three boys. He muttered a sheepish tashakkur. "It tells you the time in any city in the world," I told him. The boys nodded politely, passing the watch between them, taking turns trying it on. But they lost interest, and soon the watch sat abandoned on the straw mat. "You could have told me," Farid said later. The two of us were lying next to each other on the straw cots Wahid's wife had spread for us. "Told you what?" "Why you've come to Afghanistan," he said. His voice had lost the rough edge I had heard in it since the moment I had met him. "Well, you didn't ask," I said. "You should have told me," he said. "You didn't ask." He rolled to face me, curled his arm under his head. "Maybe I will help you find this boy." "Thank you, Farid," I said. "It was wrong of me to assume," he said. I sighed. "Don't worry. You are more right than you know." His hands are tied behind him with roughly woven rope cutting through the flesh of his wrists. He is blindfolded with black cloth. He is kneeling on the street, on the edge of a gutter filled with still water, his head drooping between his shoulders. His knees roll on the hard ground and bleed through his pants as he rocks in prayer. It is late afternoon, and his long shadow sways back and forth on the gravel. He is muttering something under his breath. I step closer. "A thousand times over," he mutters. "For you, a thousand times over." Back and forth he rocks. He lifts his face. I see a faint scar above his upper lip. "We are not alone." I see the barrel first, then the man standing behind him. He is tall, dressed in a herringbone vest and a black turban. He looks down at the blindfolded man before him with eyes that show nothing but a vast, cavernous emptiness. He takes a step back and raises the barrel, places it on the back of the kneeling man's head. For a moment, fading sunlight catches in the metal and twinkles. The rifle roars with a deafening crack. I follow the barrel on its upward arc. I see the face behind the plume of smoke swirling from the muzzle. I am the man in the herringbone vest. I woke up with a scream trapped in my throat.